you have any questions so far about this wonderful adventure that you're about to embark on or have embarked on, here's Anton, my big man here, the physics major, plays with protons and electrons and mesons and gluons and freon and everything else. Does anyone have any questions about the class so far? Anything? There's a din coming through. Maybe it's from my computer here. Let me shut off iTunes. You know where that's coming from, Jack? From the projector?
Yeah.
No, that's bad. I didn't hear it on Tuesday. The din wasn't there on Tuesday? What's the scoop? Pardon? Can we fix it? Okay. That's bad. Is it bleeding into the webcast? Okay, good. So does anyone have any questions about the class so far? Anything that we've talked about? Josh, my man.
I don't have a...
Pretty soon you won't need these name tags. I'll be able to... What's up?
The packets, the handouts we get, do we need to bring them back to every class, for example?
Well, the ones for the lecture, if you want to look at the things that I put on the board, then it's good to bring them back, because then you'll have, you know, it's like sing along with me, you know, the bouncing ball or something like that. So then you'll have that stuff. If you don't bring them back, then you won't be able to have it. So the reading articles for discussion, no, you don't have to bring them because those are for discussion. But on the other hand, the other stuff you should bring. Any other questions so far? Okay. Let me go into a few announcements and then I'll plunge in back where we were last time. And let's see. Yeah, that's where I want to go. Okay, you have a handout on this stuff. Something's bleeding through here. Okay. First thing is that this class is being webcast. That seems to be a big deal for UCLA to webcast and podcast classes. But I've been webcasting my class for about 25 years. There wasn't any web, but we used to record it using 3/4-inch tape and put it on reserve at the Powell Library. So this is kind of old hat for me. So if you want to see the lecture and hear the lecture, you can go to the OID website, which is up here, and you also have on your handout of these slides that I gave you, or you can go to the Goldberg Lab website. And if you go to the Goldberg Lab website, you'll see a little button called Teaching, and when you push that button, you'll see HC70A Winter 06, and you push that button, and you'll be able to pull this video up and a whole bunch of other things. But I'll have a whole bunch of other stuff to say. If you go to the UCLA webcast site, you'll need RealPlayer. If you go to my website, you're going to need QuickTime 7.0. And if you don't have QuickTime 7.0 on your computer, whether it's a PC or a Mac, you can download it free from Mac. But if any of you have iTunes or iPods, then you have to have QuickTime 7.0. We have a dinner tonight. And that dinner, you know who you are. And Jennifer and T and Matt and Josh and Jordan. And please hook up after class, and Jessica's going to walk you guys over there, and I'm going to meet you there, and we're going to the faculty center, and then we'll have a list sometimes next week, once I get my schedule straightened out, of exactly when the other dinners will be and where they are and all that other stuff. Now, you had a discussion yesterday, and you could not hope to be, I hope, impressed with the quality of the teaching by both Gloria and Mike, because I sit back there and there's very few professors at this university that can get up in front of students like that, you know, with being able to give a teaching presentation like that. And you can obviously see that there's a little bit of influence there in style. But the important thing is that in these discussions, you have to come prepared. And it's not that you have to come prepared for us, but you have to come prepared for yourselves, because it's a self-learning process, as I told you on Tuesday. And so that means you must read these articles carefully. And really, it's a no-no to come in and say, no, I hadn't read the article. It's great to say, I don't understand the article. That's what we want, at least in the initial stages, to know what you don't understand. But not to read it, it's like in a Goldberg class, kind of a sin. And how do we know that you haven't read the article? And that is, well, if you go around and the article's blank, it's kind of like reading, got to fix that din. Can you get someone? Is there any way we can do that, Jack? Really appreciate it. I don't know what we can do, but it's going to drive us nuts for 2.5 hours. In any case, if you haven't written anything over the article, then it's clear that perhaps you haven't looked at it as carefully. So the way to read these articles is to ask yourself a lot of questions along the way. And the way to read these articles is if I was reading an article written in a foreign language, and that is I'd have to look up the words as I went along, and I'd have to ask myself some questions and be able to read very actively. And that's the way science is read, or anything is read for that matter. And so it's critical to mark it up and to read it and, you know, ask questions and all those things, and then when you come to discussion, you'll be prepared, and even if there's things you don't understand, probably by the end of discussion, they'll be clarified either by you guys or by one of your classmates or whatever. So the key here is, in reading these articles, is you've got to ask yourself, what's the major question of the article? You want to know what the article's all about before you read it. Then you want to say, what was the approach? Because most of these articles deal with experiments. Again, what was the issue? Then what was the approach to maybe resolve or solve that issue? And then what were the results? What was the conclusion? And then what do the conclusions apply to society? Because we're going to talk about that as well. And the best way to approach these articles, frankly, is just skim them. You spend 15 seconds on them or 15 minutes in the beginning and just figure out what's this thing all about. Don't even go into any details. Okay, just get the gist of it. And then the next thing to do is to look, the way I do it, is I look at the figures. Generally, that's where the experiments are. And each figure has a legend to it that explains what's going on. And so if you take it figure by figure by figure, and this is how I've read scientific articles for God knows how many years, then you'll be able to dissect out somewhat what's going on from experiment to experiment. And then you read the thing over again to get the flow of everything. So what I'm suggesting is that you get a quick idea of what's involved. You try and understand these figures. Some of them are going to be very challenging in the beginning, but they'll be trivial in about half the quarter, as I said on Tuesday. And then you build it up again into a story. And you'll find that that's a very useful way of doing it. But when you look at these figures, you say, what's the question? What's the experiment? Even if you go, huh, I don't understand. That's good. But you'll get it. And then you go, okay, well, what was the approach? What was the technique? What was the process? What was the results? And what were the conclusions? That's the way you read a scientific article, regardless whether it's Scientific American or otherwise. And then you say, okay, now let me build up the whole story and see what the authors thought about this, the questions, the results, the conclusions, and go from there. And in the meantime, if you don't know anything, you have to look it up. And your textbook is excellent for that. But I Xeroxed off a couple chapters from a very elementary beginning recombinant DNA book that's very simple, designed for high school students. And I love it because it's so conceptual, and you'll have those chapters at the end of class today, and you're going to find them very useful, very conceptual, and very illuminating. So that's what you do with these discussion articles, and they will get easier and easier as you go and as you go along. Now, for next week, there'll be 4 articles. The main article is the first one, Useful Proteins from Recombinant DNA. That is the main article. Just like this week where you read a pioneering article, we went back in history, you read the article by Stanley Cohn, who was the first person to really do genetic engineering, and that was the Scientific American article that was written 2 years after the original research articles were written. This one is going to be an article you'll read by Wally Gilbert, who is a Nobel laureate. And Wally Gilbert's a Nobel laureate because he discovered the process of how to sequence the nucleotides in DNA, which was revolutionary at the time. And this article is also revolutionary because it's an article that describes how bacteria can be made to use drugs for the first time. So you're going to be reading really pioneering stuff. Now, there's a lot of techniques in here that we don't use anymore, and there's a lot of stuff that you're going to go, you know, huh, what's going on? But what I want you to do is try and get away with the gist of what's going on, and that is how are genes made to function in cells? How do you get a gene to be active in a bacterial cell, a human gene to be active in a bacterial cell, and what is done to essentially make a drug? And I don't have time to go into it now, but in discussion next week, hopefully we'll allude to it. It was a huge race. It was a lot of fun at that time, and a lot of good came out of it in the 70s, and you'll go back in time. But then you're going to fast forward, and you'll be reading an article which will be the modern version of that old article, Discovering Genes for Medicine, which is what we do these days. You'll be reading an article dealing with how just computers are involved in analyzing all of this information, because we can't do anything without computers anymore. And then how do people make businesses out of genes these days? And so you'll be going over a 30-year period sort of looking at a capsule of what's going on. But from a technological point of view, from a conceptual point of view, in a sense, it's the first two articles and really the first one that's important. And just keep that in mind. You can download those from the Blackboard website, which you can get at from Bruin Online, or you can take copies of them, which we have for you when you leave. But I suggest that you might want to download color copies because they're a little bit more informative from a conceptual point of view. Now, these little quizzes. You got a little quiz yesterday that's due tomorrow night. You'll have a quiz every week, basically. And these quizzes are conceptual, and they go over some, you know, simple principles that you cover in discussion and you discuss, you know, to cover in the article. And, you know, they're really designed to get you to understand how to, again, do science on paper in terms of designing experiments and outlining experiments and stuff like that. As I said on Tuesday, you should group up. And that's what's traditionally done in my class. If you want to work on your own and work by yourself, you're more than welcome to do that. That's fine. But I think it's a lot more fun and a lot more intellectually challenging when you get together in groups and debate the answers. And don't get misled by the group, you know, philosophy here. Sometimes the majority in these groups are not correct in terms of the right answer. And so in many respects, it comes out a really exciting and interesting debate in terms of how to go for the answer. But there are some rules here, and I have to emphasize what those rules are. And those rules were written on the outside of your quiz. Now, I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this, and then I won't spend any time on it whatsoever the entire quarter. So let me tell you philosophically of where I'm coming from. So please bear with me. I know it may be hard to believe, Anton, but I've been at UCLA 33 years. Isn't that an amazing amount of time? Pretty deceptive, isn't it? Except for maybe my gray hair. In any case, and I can still run a triple perimeter, which I did on New Year's Eve. In any case, the point here is that I'm not a policeman, and I don't want to be a policeman. And out of all these years that I've taught undergraduates at UCLA, you may find this surprising that I have never proctored any exam, ever. I've never had a TA in an exam. I've never asked for an ID in an exam. I've never been in an exam, whether it's written or whatever. And the reason is because I have a lot of admiration and respect for all of you, and always have. And I don't really believe that one is a policeman as a professor, nor should be a policeman as a professor. And the fact is, if someone wants to cheat, they're being, you know, they're cheating themselves. But I will say that out of all these classes that I've taught in all these years, to my knowledge, I have never, ever, ever, ever had a case of cheating. And that's the truth. Because I operate on an honor system, and I expect you to uphold that honor system. And so it's kind of like a mutual thing. I respect you guys and give you all the benefit of the doubt because I assume everybody is good and honest, and I hold those ideals and always have. And I expect you to uphold my honor system. And so what is the honor system? The honor system is that you can talk to anybody in this class about these quizzes or when you have a take-home test. You can discuss anything about these quizzes in this class with anybody in this class. However, you cannot trade answers. That means you can't Xerox off the answers and hand them to everybody. That's violation of my honor system. Second thing is you can't talk to anybody outside of this class with respect to any of these quizzes or exams. Not anybody. So you can't go to your roommate who might be a senior molecular biology major, or you can't go to somebody who may have taken this class previously, or you can't go to someone who might be, you know, a graduate student in molecular biology. It's your stuff. It's for you to learn. And so that's, again, a violation of what I consider to be, you know, my honor code. So you can't distribute the answers. And you can't, you know, ask anyone outside the class. But within the class, you can talk to anybody. You can come together as a group. You can talk in pairs. You can talk, you know, everybody. You can use any book. You can use any reference. You can use, you know, the internet, you can use anything you want. Can't use any old exams or stuff like that. But the point here is you have to work on it and try and learn it. Now, the last part of it is this, and this is the real important part. And I take this pretty seriously. On the outside of this quiz, it asks you, even though you've worked in a group, you've turned in your own quiz in your own words. It's not like, you know, you copy something. It says, do you understand the principles that you put down in your quiz? And if you don't, I don't want you to sign this. And I mean, that's an honest statement. But if you do, I want you to sign it. And if you sign it, that means that you have to be prepared in discussion session or in lecture to get up in front of the class and answer the quiz on your own. Or generally, I'll have you group up as pairs or threesomes or foursomes. I rarely have people do this on their own and put pressure on. It's always a group. And so that's the rule. And what is the success rate of this rule? Well, it's phenomenally successful because it's, why do I do this? It's just a teaching tool. It's a tool to get you to learn, which is what I'm interested in learning. And so those are really the rules. And the quiz is due by midnight in my office every Friday. And if you do it beforehand, that's fine. But by midnight, or if you can't get it to me, then feel free to email me and tell me why you couldn't get it to me because you had to go home for the weekend or whatever. And so all you have to do is just email it to me as an attachment, which is fine as well, or fax it or whatever. As long as we get it by midnight on Friday, I'm cool. But if there's some reason why it can't come in for some unforeseen circumstances, like you're sick or you know you had to go home or you had to go for an interview or there was just something, then come and talk to me about it. And generally I can be reasonably flexible about the whole thing. So there we go. Is there any question about the quizzes? Now, there's one other rule. This is a very important rule. You can't ask any questions of me about the quiz or the TAs. You can go to their office hours, but if you ask any question of us related to the quiz, we're going to deflect you. Meaning you can ask any conceptual question, like how does DNA replicate, or how do you do a restriction map, or what's a plasmid, or you know how you insert these things in bacterial cells, but it can't be like, you know, what about this, and mask the process? It's, you know, it's your own work, and it's a lot of fun, and it's a big challenge. And you're going to see, again, I can't, you know, it's like saying, oh, what is it like to be, you know, a certain age? Well, you don't know until you get there. And so when you get there, you're going to see how much you learn from all of this. Any questions? Samantha, the math major.
If you're not in your office, do you want us to try and just slip it under the door?
Oh, there'll be a place. Turn the microphone on. There'll be a place that you will be able to see that quiz and where it's due, right? I mean, it'll be like a billboard on Sunset Strip.
When will that be up?
That will be up after class today.
Okay.
Okay. It could be up after discussion yesterday. We just didn't. We're just so swamped with the beginning of, you know, organizing everything. But it'll be up. And if it's not up, just give it to me or give it to somebody. It'll get to me. Any other questions? I haven't told you about grading or anything. I'm not going to do that till next week. But is there any questions? I generally don't do that for a while. Okay? They'll be bony. Well, you saw it already. Okay. That's the quizzes. Now, office hours, 11 to 2 on Wednesday. And if you had taken any of my classes in previous years, it would mean 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. But I'm trying to be more reasonable and change my hours. So it's 11 in the morning. I might not have gone home or gone to sleep, but it's 11 in the morning to 2 in the afternoon on Wednesday, which means feel free to come in before your discussion and discuss anything with me prior to the discussion, okay? And then Mike's office hours are tomorrow between 10 in the morning and noon. Previous years it would have been 10 p.m. and midnight, but we've changed that. And so he'll be there between 10 a.m. and noon in my conference room, which is down my hall. And Gloria will be there between noon and 2 p.m. And that's a good time to go over things because then your quizzes do that night and you can get helped and stuff like that. And if you need more office hours, we can figure that stuff up. Next thing is you have this other book called The Double Helix. Please start reading it. It's a lot of fun. It's kind of like, well, you could read it in an afternoon. And believe me, it's a good read. You won't be able to put it down. How many of you read The Double Helix? So one of you. Do you like it, Sam? It's a really good book. Did you read it just recently or did you?
A
long time ago. It's great, isn't it? You'll love it. It's about discovery of the structure of DNA. And we'll talk more about that later. Now, there is a wonderful book for any of you who are thinking of doing any kind of work on the interface of history and science, because this whole recombinant DNA thing is a tremendous topic for like an undergraduate thesis or a term paper or whatever, if you're involved in history or political science or whatever. And it was just published, and it's by a guy by the name of Donald Fredrickson, who just passed away recently. And Donald Fredrickson was the head of the National Institutes of Health for many, many, many years, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and he was the one that was the director of the NIH when all the recombinant DNA stuff came down in the 70s. And so I suggest very strongly that you, if you're interested in that kind of stuff, you take a look at it, and you can get it, you know, from Amazon or whatever, but it's a marvelous, 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 marvelous topic. And let me just show you a little bit of what I'm talking about in a second, if I can pull this thing up. Okay, bear with me again on the technology. There. Last night this thing crashed on me, so I should say early this morning, so we'll see how it goes. There we go. Now what do? I click on it, I'm assuming. There we go. And I go beginning of the disk, because I don't know how to set the thing, and you guys are much better than I am. And Mike, remember we couldn't figure this thing out? So there we go. Let's keep it going after the FBI stuff. Come on. And, oh, I know what to do. There we go. Not getting a lot of sound out of here. There we go. Thank you. Now, I think I go to the menu, which is where I want to go. And I want to go to chapter selections. Bear with me. And I want to go risks versus rewards. That's it.
Spread quickly. Everyone wanted to try gene splicing to see what they could create. But just as the new science was about to take off, there were the first rumblings of trouble. When they reported this, many people were astounded that it could be done that easily, and the promise that provided for new kinds of experimental approaches. But there were a few people in the audience who, in fact, were concerned about the possibility that people would put things into these bacteria that would, in fact, create some public health hazard. At Paul Berg's lab, they were experimenting with genes that cause cancer. He wanted to splice cancer genes with bacteria genes, but his plans set off alarm bells. One of my students, regular talk about what was going on in her home lab. That seemed to have invoked a huge concern amongst...
You read about this for a discussion yesterday.
And Pollack told her he thought that was the most dangerous and outrageous experiment that anybody could possibly...
Paul Berg is a Nobel laureate.
Berg had proposed transferring cancer genes into a widely studied bacterium called E. coli. Unfortunately, this bacterium also thrives inside the human gut.
You have tons of bacteria in your gut. The most common of these is E. coli. My scenario is, you handle these bacteria, they have a tumor gene in them, they get into your gut, you have no idea. You don't have diarrhea, you have no symptoms, and they live there. And they propagate there. And they make clones, and they're very happy there. And then a piece of the DNA gets out and makes a tumor in your gut. I called Paul Berg, and we had two conversations. The first of which was very abrupt, and I don't think a phone conversation we thought it was violent, but it was unpleasant.
He called me to convey his concern And I said, I thought it was bunk.
Remember, this is 1975.
This was absurd. I didn't see any risk to it.
You ever scratch your head? You ever pick your nose, touch your nose, touch your nose, like that? That's it. If you're in a lab with E. coli, brings E. coli into your gut. Simple.
I thought that was highly unlikely, but nevertheless, after some consideration and consultation, I came to the conclusion that I could not say with 100% assurance that this experiment would pose zero risk.
Byrd called for a temporary halt to all genetic engineering experiments. He invited biology's leading thinkers to a summit to assess the real risks.
We're worried about some of these experiments. Why don't we all talk about it and see collectively whether there is, in fact, any basis for this concern? Are there risks? And if there are, what do we do about it?
It was a period just after the Vietnam War. People were concerned about doing things that would come back to haunt us. So I think there was probably a little extra sensitivity to doing something responsible.
The ban on DNA experiments put the future of genetic engineering in the balance. Paul Byrd warned that if scientists didn't police themselves and control this new technology, then the government might intervene and shut them down. The scientists agreed to meet in California to set guidelines. But one of DNA's founding fathers, Jim Watson, was concerned that airing doubts might awaken public anxiety.
Human society is prospered because it tries new things. Some people are afraid to do new things. I guess you call them conservative. I've never been conservative about moving ahead unless I had reason to worry. I thought these people just want the world to stay as it is. And I don't want the world to stay as it is.
In what used to be a church in Asilomar, California, 150 scientists gathered from all over the world to discuss the fate of their research. Scientists wrestled with a paradox. They were excited by what recombining genes could tell them about nature, but some were afraid they might damage forever the very life they sought to understand.
In the press, the danger became magnified, as if we were equating the danger from recombinant DNA to nuclear energy.
In addition to the scientists, a select group of lawyers and journalists had been invited. They were surprised to hear that most of those planning experiments had little experience of handling infectious agents in the lab. It was all too easy to imagine a disaster scenario.
Part of what went on was that people in microbiology who were familiar with some of the dangers of the pathogens that were being used experimentally began to educate their molecular colleagues about taking necessary precautions. And they were rather horrified. And some, there were some jokes that went on, were exchanged about the kinds of things people had done. Some of the people who were experienced hooted at us and say, you know, you people are so sloppy, you don't even know any of the techniques to work with these kinds of organisms. How could you be contemplating doing something which is possibly of some risk?
I was saying communism in action is sort of, thought police. There are so many things you should worry about. And I just thought this was a minor one for the world.
I'm going to take issue with it because you have people around you, and if they're banging on your door saying, you know, we're worried about what you're doing, you try to do everything you can to protect them. point of the conference was to discuss how to make genetic engineering safe. But the delegates couldn't contain their excitement with the science itself.
The exchange of scientific information really built up a crescendo of interest among the scientists here. And one of the most interesting places to stand during the breaks in the meeting was near the telephone.
No cell phones in those days.
People lined up to get to the payphone and to call their labs and say, oh, I've just learned this or that wonderful thing. When I get back next week, we're going to start on this or that. They were simply learning from each other. The presentations here were cutting-edge presentations.
I feel very strongly that it is an experiment we should not categorically ever be done here.
As the scientific debate flourished, questions of public safety took a back seat. We're about to receive a reality check.
The last night, just before we broke for the beer, was when the lawyers spoke. They were the last ones on the program that night. And they put the fear of God into people in the audience.
It was exhilarating to hear about the delightfully clever things your colleagues have just discovered. So you may emerge from the session not filled with concern over the hazards, but inspired instead by desire to pursue the research to the next tantalizing.
That's program. That guy. Listen to this.
Does not encompass freedom to cause physical injury to others. I think that
not everyone welcomed the lawyer's warnings.
I've always disliked them. because they want to put up obstacles.
Part, I thought, of my mission that evening was to ask them to step back and re-examine why they were here and to realize that if they didn't do it, there were a lot of people standing around in the rest of society who would be rushing in to do it.
Let them sue us. If you look, Congress only acts after someone gets sick or disaster. Nothing had happened. So I don't really think laws would have been passed unless something had happened.
This is another Nobel laureate here.
Sidney Brenner was so convinced the risks were minimal that before he came to Asilomar, he used himself as a human guinea pig.
I said, I want to do an experiment on myself. Oh, they said, you should get advice on this. So I said, who should I get advice from? Oh, they said, well, talk to somebody about it. This you've got to do. It's human experimentation. So I sort of said, they didn't tell me who to talk to, so I thought, I could go and talk to someone in a pub and say, what do you think? I'd like to do this experiment. However, I did talk to someone. They said, well, they thought it was okay.
Brenner grew up strains of genetically modified bacteria and drank them mixed in milk.
So there it was. It didn't taste very nice, I have to say.
Every day, he collected his excrement to search for signs of foreign genes. He didn't find any. For Brenner, that showed that the DNA was broken down in the human gut and rendered harmless. Despite the scatological evidence, the delegates remained divided. After much argument, they decided to grade experiments according to their potential danger. The most hazardous would have to be conducted in sealed labs. Form of containment would be called P4. Researchers had to wear protective suits with self-contained air supplies. They entered the lab through an airlock. It was like working in space. The guidelines may have been draconian, but at least they were clear. And the government gave the science the stamp of approval.
The process of Asilomar created an investment capital field. It caught the eye of investors. The fact that it might be potentially dangerous, that it was then cleared by the government, got an official imprimatur of safety, made it For events that are very romantic and tragic. That's the unintended consequence.
So, that was a tremendous period in biological history. And I remember it very, very vividly because I was just brand new assistant professor setting up my own lab and wanting to do these experiments. And in truth, it wasn't really a major concern that there was going to be something significant that was going to happen. And when the recombinant DNA guidelines came into place, it was just, you know, we just followed them. And we followed them to the letter of the law because we couldn't submit our grant and therefore couldn't get our money. If we couldn't get our money, I wouldn't have a job. And since I was scared to death that I didn't have a job, everyone followed this and did it because we thought it was right. I mean, it wasn't simply because we were doing it to follow the rules. It was right. Anytime you have a new revolutionary technology, it's good to proceed step by step by step, slowly, just to gather more data and see what's going on. I very, very, very strongly disagree with Bob Pollack and have for many, many, many years. He seems to think and still thinks that it was because of the start of the biotechnology industry that all of the recombinant DNA guidelines fell by the wayside. Quite the contrary. The history will show that it was a period between 1973 and 1977 where many, many, many scientists worked to get biological containment, vectors that couldn't survive outside the environment, E. coli cells that would die outside of the laboratory. These things were distributed quite readily between laboratories in that period. And what really happened was that there was a lot of data that was gathered that said that most of this stuff is really pretty safe as long as you follow these particular rules, follow the right kind of containment, use the right kind of biological and physical containment. But more than that, I think what really, really, really got this technology going, perhaps more than anything, was the realization that only in a very few short years recombinant insulin existed and recombinant growth hormone existed. And now individuals who were diabetics could be treated with the normal drug, human insulin called Humulin, or individuals that were of short stature now could become a little bit taller and normal in size because of human growth hormone. And it was because of all of that, I think, where things sort of fell by the wayside, not in terms of the requirements for what you had to do in the laboratory, but the general acceptance of the technology. And what was really a vehement protest in 73 and 74 at the end of the Vietnam War, vehement protests by minority of people exercising, you know, their points of view, which in those days we all did, all of those protests fell by the wayside because of the benefits that came out of this technology, both in basic knowledge and in practical application in terms of real-life curing of real people. And so it's a fascinating, fascinating period, and I'm sure there's a variety of points of view in terms of exactly what was going on in that period, but I wanted to show you that just to show you a little bit of the players, and I'm going to show you a little bit more in a few minutes. Okay, let me pick up where I left off. Is there any comments about Asilomar or, you know, the controversy, or do you want to know any details or anything? Yeah, Sam.
At this point, all we talked about...
Get the microphone. Yeah.
All the video was talking about was concerns with safety and to the public safety.
Yeah.
Was there a separate debate going on about ethical issues or scientists saying that maybe it's not our job as scientists to change evolution or meddle with that was just different people?
It was all part of the same debate. I mean, people were always, you know, do we break the species barrier, so to speak? Although that had been done now that we know for billions of years. We just didn't know it because we didn't have the tools to see it. But now we know that it did exist. But of course, that was part of the whole debate. And by and large, you know, frankly, those of us who do this, you know, we don't work 100 hours a week simply because, you know, we think we're doing something. You know, we have brothers and sisters and parents and grandparents and children. And so I think, again, it's mitigating what the costs versus the benefits are. And the idea was that if you're working in a laboratory under contained conditions, the chances of some of these things getting out into the environment and causing some super bug or something else is really nil, as compared to natural processes where, for example, antibiotic resistance just by normal biological processes has become such, and now in this day and age, become such a horrendous problem and had nothing to do with recombinant DNA. And if you can get up the scenario of, you know, biological warfare and all those things, I can take one seed of a plant that grows all over Southern California and grind it up. I'm not going to tell you what that plant is. And I could get more toxin from that one seed to put in someone's water supply that could wipe out a half a city. So, I mean, you don't have to conjure up these doomsday scenarios with recombinant DNA and genetic engineering. How about Ebola, polio virus, flu virus, all these things? And so from the point of view of thinking cost versus benefit, let's contain it in the laboratory. Let's move step by step by step, slowly, recognizing what we're doing and try and understand what the benefits are versus the costs. But it's a good question. Any other questions? Yeah.
I was just wondering what the...
Uditha. Is that how I pronounce your
Uditha.
Name?
Uditha.
Uditha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Go ahead.
A lot of times when there are scientific conferences like this, it's kind of, it stays within the field and people don't really know about it. It stays within the field of scientists and the general public doesn't know about it. I was wondering what the general public gauge on this event was. Was it in the media? How did people feel about it?
Oh, man. Go back in the archives in New York Times. This was all over. This was headlines. I mean, this was, you know, hippies all over the place. You should have seen me in those days, you know, although I was for the technology. But, yeah, this was as big a controversy as stop plant genetic engineering, the next ecological disaster of the world. Okay. I mean, this was the Vietnam War time, and so, yes, protests were very common. And the Asilomar conference had journalists and people from the public sector, but mostly scientists. But then the recombinant DNA committee, the original one, had lay people, it had ordinary people, it had people from theological sector, it had scientists at all different cross sections of society. And in fact, during this period of time, there was, and we'll talk about this later on in the class, there was only one example, in fact, it affected science in many respects, there was one example of a particular city called Cambridge, Massachusetts, which has a lesser known university within its, a couple lesser known universities within its city borders and boundaries, and the Cambridge City Council tried to ban under its police powers, because promote the general welfare, under its police powers, all recombinant DNA within its city borders. And there was a mayor at the time by the name of Mayor Vellucci who said, you know, how do I know some of these creepy bugs aren't going to get into the cornflakes that are in that grocery store across the street and hurt some of the children, and I have the responsibility to shut this stuff down. And what it did was it shut it down and had half the scientists that were doing this at Harvard move to Caltech and UCLA and Stanford and a variety of other places, much like what's going on with stem cell research today. So, yeah, I mean, it was big. I mean, this was the biggest thing to hit science since the recent cloning and all those other things. So public was very aware. In general, the public was very much in favor of this because this was a time at which we didn't know anything about cancer genes. We didn't know anything about what a gene was, and there were all these diseases going around. People were looking for hope, Any other questions, and I'll move on. It's a great period. I could talk, you know, half a class on it because it's fascinating historically. Okay, let me move back to where I was last time, if I can, and then I'll move forward and ask you guys some questions in a few minutes. Okay, where am I at here? Let's see where I'm at. It's not what I wanted, but that's okay. I thought I had wiped that out, but there. Okay. Last time I was talking about a variety of different things. And last time I was talking about what the era that we lived in, and I went over that probably many more times than I wanted to. But the fact is that I had discussed that we live in this marvelous era of gene engineering, genes, DNA, genomics, and mammalian reproduction. And I went through the fact that this age of DNA is in the home. I gave you a couple examples of that. And then I started on the age of genetic engineering, and I said that the age of genetic engineering is in the home. And I talked about a couple examples of this green fluorescent protein and how it was put into, from jellyfish, into a variety of creatures. And in doing that, I demonstrated, or you rather demonstrated for me, what that scientific process was in terms of what we gained, and I'm going to come back to this in a few minutes, what we gained in terms of knowledge from those experiments of taking a gene from one organism and putting it into another organism. But the fact of the matter is that it worked. And I showed you many of these different slides that I'm not going to go through again, but that's really where I was. The key here is that one could, in this age of genetic engineering, do a variety of different things using this technology, a variety of different things. And so it's not only taking the gene from the jellyfish and putting it into mouse, and as you'll see, into monkeys, and putting into plants, as you saw last time, but we can do a variety of different things. Taking genes from one organism, putting them into another organism, and getting them to work. And you're going to understand exactly how that occurs and what the process is. But we can do a little bit more. And so the examples that I showed you on Tuesday were examples of taking a gene from an animal and either putting it into another animal or taking the gene from an animal and putting it into a plant. But now what about taking a gene from a bacteria and putting it into a plant and getting that gene from a bacteria to work? And if any of you are gardeners, you probably may or may not have heard about a thing called BT, big T, big B, small T. You can buy this in any gardening store as little spores because it's something from a bacillus bacteria, and it's used to control, as you can see in this issue of Sunset Magazine, caterpillars. And it's been used for about 100 years. About 100 years, and it's still used very widely in organic farming in order to get rid of caterpillars on plants. And so the spores of this bacillus contain a protein, which is called BT toxin, T-O-X-I-N, Bacillus thuringiensis toxin, and it's toxic to these worms, and it's very highly animal specific. In other words, it doesn't harm us at all in any way. This is 100 years of use, but the protein is toxic because it binds to the guts of these worms, and it causes these worms to have a massive case of indigestion. And so this gene from this bacteria has been isolated. It was isolated 20 years ago or more, and it's known what the gene does in terms of what the protein is, probably the most well-studied bacterial gene that there is. And this gene was engineered, again, 20 years ago, to be able to operate in a plant. A bacterial gene doesn't ordinarily operate in an animal or a plant. You'll find out why next week in discussion. But it was tinkered with in order so that this bacterial gene could work inside a plant. And here's what the result of that was. It's a time-lapse photography. Take a look on one side, which was the control, which is the genetically engineered plant. Take a look on your left side, which is the control, which is the non-genetically engineered plant, and notice what's happening. The worm is eating away the leaves of this tobacco plant in the laboratory. The control, the genetically engineered plant, is not being touched in any way, shape, or form, which is this one. Notice that this worm is growing. Notice that that crop is being destroyed. And imagine that you're living in Africa and your entire livelihood and food supply is dependent upon making a crop. And notice that if you get an infestation, in this case these are hornworms, what's going to happen to your crop? This is exactly what's going to happen to your crop. And the only way you're going to be able to get rid of these worms is by hand-picking them off or spraying them with insecticides. And when you go to developing countries, people that spray the insecticides are women and children in the fields with pretty toxic stuff. Notice this particular plant here. Nothing has happened. The worm didn't grow. It bit into the plant. It ate a little bit of that BT toxin, which is not harmful to human beings, and the worms die. The point here is now you can have a plant, and there are plants as such, corn plants and a variety of other plants. You can have a plant that now can be grown without any use of insecticide whatsoever because it's been genetically engineered to be insect resistant. We're going to talk a little bit more about that later, but the story here is that you can take a bacterial gene and you can put it inside a plant and you can get it to work. So what might a farmer say about this technology? This is a guy living in Iowa, a real farmer.
High yielding crops, but using far fewer chemicals to do it.
We've used 20 to 40% less herbicide and less insecticide since the GMO products have come out here. This has saved a lot of trips over the field, and it's just a more chemically free crop now.
How does this affect what you get in the grocery store in terms of health?
Well, the best way I can describe that is, what would you rather have? Would you rather have a corn that had a bug in it, had been sprayed with insecticide a couple of times, or would you rather have a BT engineered corn where there's
We'll talk about that a lot later. It's not important from the point of view of this to go into that now. In a couple weeks, we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about the issues involved. We'll talk about the pros, the cons, and all those other things. But from the point of view of this discussion, you can take bacterial genes, you can tinker with them, and you can put them in plants, and you can make them insect-resistant. And you can do a variety of other kinds of things, obviously. Okay, now, what else can you do with this technology? Now I'd like to turn to your handout again, which if you're not looking at it, I will be. You can take this green fluorescent protein and you can play with it a little bit more. And so what you can also do is stick it in a monkey. And so not only can you take this animal gene and stick it in another animal, but you can stick it in an animal that's very closely related to us, which is a rhesus monkey, and you can use, in this case, the red fluorescent protein, and you can get a monkey to glow. And so one can then start engineering organisms using this technology, which are a little bit more closely aligned to us. Second push. There we go. More closely aligned to us, which is a rhesus monkey. And we're going to talk a little bit later today about how this is done. But in fact, you can do this kind of engineering. So again, there's no limitations. And that's what I said last time. There's absolutely no limitations to what we're doing. Now, let me give you some more startling examples of what is happening with this, or what you can do with this particular technology. And I'm just going to give you a few which are exemplary of the principle of what I'm talking about. And then we're going to talk about exactly what it means. So this was an experiment that was carried out almost 25 years ago. And it was an experiment that used a human growth hormone gene, that was put into a mouse by injecting it, much like I showed you last time, into the egg. We're taking naked DNA for a human growth hormone gene. We're injecting it into the egg of a mouse so that it goes into the nucleus of the mouse and into the chromosome. And we're taking that engineered egg, basically, fertilizing it, embedding it in a surrogate mother, so to speak. And then what's happening is that we're getting little pups and little mice. And I'm not going to tell you exactly how this is done yet, but I will sometime in the class. But the point here is that you can identify the presence of that gene by a DNA fingerprint. And there it is, right over there. So you know that it's there by doing DNA fingerprinting. And then you can say, well, what will be the results of having this human growth hormone gene active in this mouse in a way in which I'm not going to get into? And what will happen is, well, out of this you get Mighty Mouse. And there it is. So you can see that this mouse is a lot bigger than the non-engineered mouse there. And so you can engineer this mouse to be much bigger in size than the normal mouse. And in fact, this is sometimes used now in animals to get them a little bit bigger to get more meat. But the point is, notice that the date is 1982. It was published in 1982, which means the experiment was probably carried out in 1980, which means in a sense, it's a 25-year-old technology and a 25-year-old experiment, and it's pretty spectacular. So let me just say this again. We have a pure piece of DNA representing a specific gene for growth hormone from humans. We're putting it into the fertilized egg, so to speak, of a mouse. We're putting it back into the mouse, and we're getting a mighty mouse getting back. So what does this say? What does this say? Where's Brian? Where are you? One of the Brians in here. I noticed you. Brian, where are you? Brian Chu. I know you're here. There you are. Did you hear me or not? Yeah, go ahead. Brian, you. Yeah. What does this say about genes? What does this tell you about a piece of DNA?
Well, it basically goes to show that the DNA really can... basically,
what's your hypothesis?
The four bases that are used in one animal are the same in a different animal. So when it's inserted to a different animal, as long as the mechanisms to
speak into the mic. What does this say about this naked piece of DNA, Brian?
It can be inserted to another animal and still.
Okay, that's one thing. It can be inserted from one animal to another. But what does it say about that piece of DNA?
It can
more
also,
profoundly.
It can also be functional.
And what do you mean by that?
The gene is expressed, whatever that
you
gene
means
is.
It can direct a particular function. correct? Yes. A piece of DNA, just a pure little chemical, can direct a particular function. What else does it say about that piece of DNA? It's even just as profound as that. Samantha? Did I have your name right? Heather, go ahead. I'll get it.
That genes are universal between
it says
all
that
organisms.
Genes are universal, can be transferred from one organ to another. What do you mean by universal?
That they're not species specific, I guess. Like a plant doesn't have a specific plant gene.
Yeah, it does actually. What do you mean by universal? Not the gene, but what is it, the substance of the gene?
The DNA.
The DNA is universal. And does that also say that the structure of DNA might be universal?
Yes.
Because if the structures were different, you'd never be able to do this experiment, correct?
Correct.
Okay, what else does it say? Brian. You missed something right here. Notice on this figure that you have in front of you that there are little puppies that come out of all this. So what does it else say about that piece of DNA? So we have this mouse, right? And we get all these other little mice out. And they might be giant mice too. What does it say about that piece of DNA? Jason.
That the DNA might not work also?
That what?
That it might not work also?
Might not work? No. What does it say about that? What does it say? Charles. Charles.
Should I wait for the mic?
Yeah, get the mic. Where are the other mics? I know we have more than one. Let's just spread them out here.
Hello.
Go ahead.
If it's transferred into the other mice, then that means that the DNA was assimilated into the... It's transferred to the offspring.
Yeah, what does that mean?
It means that it's become a part of the mouse's
what
DNA.
What does that mean? Yeah, it's become part of it, but a lot of things can become part of something, right? So what does that mean? What does it mean? Brian?
It means it becomes hereditary, like you can pass it on.
You can pass it on. So what does that mean? It means that piece of DNA has the property of what? What's a Xerox machine do?
Oh, you can copy?
Yeah, it has the ability to copy itself. That's the fundamental basis of what a gene is. A gene means something's inherited. You can get lots of things to function, but you can't get things to be passed on from generation to generation. Charles, you look like your mom or your dad? Even a little bit?
They're Asian, but most people say I don't.
Yeah? Do you look even a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
Where do you think the genes came from?
Their
what fraction
parents.
Of your genes were from your mom and what fraction of your genes from your dad? Alexandra. You're positive?
No.
You're not? Of course you are. It's 50% from your mom and 50% from your dad. So you couldn't have that happen if they didn't have the property of being able to replicate. So what does this experiment show, Brian? Take the microphone. It shows that you can transfer a gene from a human to a mouse, but what does it tell us about the properties of genes? What's the substance?
DNA, and that it can...
And what can the DNA do by itself?
Replicate and therefore be
passed on. And what can the DNA also do? Was there a super mouse before it had that piece of DNA?
No. So it'd be some kind of new...
Yeah, so it can confer a new phenotype, a new property to an organism. And that's what shows that DNA is the genetic material. And I'm going to show you a little bit older experiment than that next time. But the point is that that's really profound. That's what that experiment shows. So it's not that we make the super mouse. That's trivial. It's what we learn about biology from this experiment that counts. Now, what about another one? Let's give another example. Is it Esther or Easter? Easter. How many X chromosomes do you have in your cells?
Two.
How many do I have?
One.
Well, let's stick biologically rather than sociologically. Could you imagine any females to be XY biologically?
If they had more than two, but usually
people with more than two chromosomes.
Well, how come I'm a guy? Because I have a Y chromosome.
Because the Y chromosome contains the genes to express themselves in a body when the fetus is developing to give mm-hmm. them the genitalia of a man mm-hmm. or woman.
Mm-hmm. So I have a gene somehow in my chromosome someplace.
Yes.
That dictates that I have a penis and testicles, correct?
Yes.
And look like a guy, so to speak, right? And it's on the Y chromosome. How do you know it's on the Y chromosome?
Because
why don't you design an experiment to tell me that it's on the Y chromosome?
The difference between men and women on the
well, design
genetic
an experiment,
level,
though, that you would do.
You can compare the chromosomes of a man and a woman and see
one
that
man and one woman?
Many.
Okay. So first thing, what would you do? Would you get a population of people?
Yes.
So you'd compare
I would use a different organism than a person.
Different organism than a person.
So maybe
we want to
mice.
Know about humans, though. Because what you might learn from horses might not apply to humans. So how would you do this in humans? In this room, what would you do?
Get a sample of everyone's DNA.
The DNA, what would be a little bit easier? Can you see the chromosomes? Remember we saw that film yesterday in discussion?
Yes, with a microscope.
Yeah, you could see. So what cells would you get from all of us in this room?
Maybe a cheek swab.
Yeah, exactly. Get some cheek cells, and then you'd look under the microscope, right?
Yes.
And you'd look at the different chromosomes, correct? And what would you look for? What would be your prediction?
You would look for a difference between
exactly.
the men and the women.
Exactly. You wouldn't know what that difference is, but you'd look for some difference.
Yes.
And if you saw a difference and it was consistent 100%, what would some of your inferences be?
That there is a difference between men and women on a chromosomal
And then
level.
What would you infer from the difference in the chromosome? Let's say there was a little chromosome that you only found in the males and you never found this little tiny chromosome in the females.
Then that particular chromosome would carry the gene for that gender.
Exactly. And that's exactly what people found at the turn of the century. But more than that, people found that on that little chromosome called the Y chromosome, that's good. Think about it in terms of an experiment here, not just in terms of description. Jessica, you did a great job. Think about the fact that you do have these chromosomes, and you have these chromosomes that have a particular kind of gene. So what would you think? You're not done yet, Jessica. What would you think if I handed you that gene for maleness and you could insert it into the egg of, let's say, now a mouse, because we're not going to do this with humans, that you knew didn't have that chromosome but would maybe just had XX chromosomes, didn't have any male chromosome. But you have the gene, and you wanted it injected into the egg of this mouse, much like I showed you with the growth hormone. What do you think might happen?
And you already know that it has two X chromosomes?
You already know that that egg has two X chromosomes, yes. You already know that.
From my
science, what's your prediction?
That the organism would die because if there's more than...
To have one gene, we're not inserting it...
Oh, you're just inserting
XXY the
gene,
is not lethal.
Not the
XXY is not lethal. Even if you injected a Y chromosome, it'd still be viable. So what if you just injected this gene into that egg? What would happen?
It could potentially assimilate the gene
and
express
if it
those
did,
traits.
What would you predict?
That it would express the traits.
And then what would it be? The pups that come out, would they be male or female?
Male.
Exactly. And so let's do that experiment on the board. We get the gene from humans. It's called SRY. That's the gene. It's called SRY. We take that gene that's been isolated by recombinant DNA in cloning, and we insert it into this female, which really has two X chromosomes here. I'm not going to tell you how I know it's two X chromosomes, but there's one, and there's another, essentially. And we insert it into that egg of that mouse that's destined to become a female, and I think that that's a male. There's the testicles, and there's the penis. And I think it's very clear that one gene can change the gender of that particular organism very easily. Now, one last question then, Jessica. What does that say about that piece of DNA?
That it's transferable.
Right.
That it's
Go ahead.
That it can be taken up by the X chromosome and not just the Y.
Or any chromosome. doesn't have to be on the X. It could be on any chromosome, as long as it's in the nucleus and in the chromosomes. It doesn't matter where it is. Possible?
Yes.
Exactly. So it could be anywhere. And if you have that one gene, what is that able to do? This one naked piece of DNA, going back to what we just said with the growth hormone, what does that say?
That gene has a specific function.
Exactly. And it's different than the growth hormone, isn't it?
Yes.
And what does it say about the piece of DNA for the growth hormone and the piece of DNA for the sex? Can they work independently of each other?
Yes.
They don't need each other to work properly, do they?
No.
So what does that say about how genes work as individual entities, T? What does that say about how genes work as individual entities? Can the gene work by itself?
Yes.
I just gave you examples, a bacterial gene in a plant, a growth hormone gene in an animal, sex gene. You don't need them together, do they? So what does that say, Jessica, about the property of a gene? Get Brian to help you. What does it say about the property of a gene? I'm going back to this Brian here. Chris, hand it to him.
Really, that the genes... Wait, can you repeat the question?
What does that say about a gene? Is it an independent entity?
Yes, it is.
It's an independent physical entity. You've got it in your hand. You're putting it in something. We're not waving a magic wand. There's no hocus pocus or magic or anything. You've got it. It's here. You had it in your hands on Tuesday. At least all of them, but now you have one of them. You're putting it inside this egg and you're changing the sex. That means that gene simplistically works independently of another gene. Okay, let me give you another example. Here's a gene that codes for a protein called leptin. It's not important to know what it is, but now we engineer this mouse with this particular gene. And notice that we get an obese mouse. So it's a way of using mice as a model to study obesity. Because now we have a mouse that's obese because we've engineered it to be obese, and now we can study the disease, obesity, in mice rather than in people. And that's really caused a lot of major breakthroughs in terms of being able to treat obesity in humans. But it's the same principle. It's a naked piece of DNA in which we can change some property of this organism in a very profound and specific way. But let me give you another example, yet another, and then I'll give you one final one, which is the coup de grace, so to speak. And that is, now let's say we want to make a drug in an animal, and let's say we want to make this thing called trypsin tissue plasminogen activator, TPA, and we want to make lots of it, and we want to make lots of it in an organism closely related to humans because some of the cellular processes are similar, and the protein will have a greater chance of being produced like it would be produced in humans. And so now we engineer the egg of this goat with this human piece of DNA, but now we go one step further. We tell this piece of DNA by engineering that it only can be active in the udder of the goat. So we engineer it not to be active everywhere in the goat, like the growth hormone gene was in the mouse, but we engineer it to be only active in the udder mammary glands of the goat. And now the goat milk, which is produced there, now produces, along with its milk proteins, it produces this drug, and this drug then can be isolated and be used to treat humans with heart attack, and that's exactly how it's made in goats and sheep and other organisms. And so one can do this, again, in the same principle, the same way to make pharmaceuticals, and we're going to talk about that in a couple weeks. Now, the final example is that I'm going to give you, and that is, what about human beings? What about engineering human beings? So the example that I'm going to give you is of an individual that's now probably about almost your age, but not quite. This individual was born with a lethal genetic disease, the lethal genetic disease being SCID. Why don't you turn that off? SCID. SCID. Severe combined immunodeficiency. That is a rare genetic disease, SCID, severe combined immunodeficiency. If you're born with that genetic disease, Betty, if you're born with that genetic disease, you die because you have absolutely no immune system. And from the day of birth to the day you pass, you live in a bubble because you cannot have any exposure to any pathogens whatsoever because you have no way to fight them off. And so these individuals suffer this tragic, tragic disease that not only is it lethal, but the parents that give rise to this little child have no ability to ever touch it, and it cannot touch anybody or anything. And so they live in a bubble, unless they're treated in some way. And this severe combined immunodeficiency is due to a defect in a gene called ADA, adenine deaminase. It's an enzyme. ADA. And it's not important to know what this enzyme does, except it's involved in the metabolism, that is, the chemistry in your body of nucleotides. It's involved in breaking nucleotides down after they're utilized. And if you have a defect in this gene, that enzyme won't work. And if that enzyme doesn't work, toxic compounds build up in white blood cells, which produce antibodies, and therefore you have no immune system because the white blood cells basically are gone, and therefore you have to have something done to do it, to be able to stay alive. And so the normal ADA gene, and you're going to have a lot of fun reading about this later on in the quarter, the normal ADA gene was injected into the bone marrow cells of a child that had this lethal disease, and the bone marrow cells were then engineered with a normal ADA gene, and the bone marrow cells were then put back in to the individual, and the individual then had a normal ADA gene and therefore had an immune system because it was able to break down these nucleotides and able to live. And what this says is that there's human beings walking around that are genetically engineered. I'm going to say that again. There are human beings walking around that are, in fact, genetically engineered. They carry a gene of which they were not born with. That's genetic engineering. Yeah, people have a lot of problems with genetically engineering plants, but it doesn't seem to be any problem with genetically engineering a human being to keep them alive. I don't think any of us have an argument with that. But I want to point out that this technology has gone all the way to the human level and will continue on the human level for the rest of eternity for doing a variety of all kinds of really positive things, like shutting down cancer genes, like shutting down genes that might have people have scabs on their skin, like shutting down all kinds of viral infections. This is a very powerful, powerful technology, still in its infancy, even though it's 25 years old, and we're still learning a lot. But the point is that you can do this genetic engineering, and you can do it with human beings. And what all of this has told us is the following. What all of this has told us, and you don't have this thing because I added it last night, because the one you have I wasn't happy with. What all of this tells us is that genetic processes in living organisms are in fact universal. This was not read out of a textbook. This was done by these kinds of experiments, by hundreds and hundreds of scientists. And what it says is that if you can pass DNA from one organism to another, the processes of getting that DNA active into doing something have to be universal. And furthermore, it says that the structure of the gene must be universal, the DNA. The processes are universal, the structure of the gene is universal, and what it says is that the process, which we'll talk about more next week, that the process of a gene, which is replicating itself, and the process of a gene of dictating some function inside of a cell occurs similarly in almost all creatures. And that's what these experiments have said. And so when one does genetic engineering, it's the ultimate organic process. We're not adding anything to cells. We're not subtracting anything from cells in terms of the machinery. We're using the machinery of the cell just as it's used normally in order to carry out something which we want to carry out, which the cell might not be able to do, or we might want to make it to do better, or we might want to do something differently, but the point is that we're using basic genetic processes in order to do this. There's no hocus pocus, there's no magic wand, we're not adding magical chemicals, we're not changing the properties of the cells, we're not doing anything but using cellular processes. And what that says is, it says that in a sense, we can intervene in these processes in order to be able to bring about desired consequences. And I think that is the really startling point of what genetic engineering is all about. Matt, do you have any questions? Am I clear? Crystal?
Very clear.
Crystal? Remember the movie? With Jack Nicholson? Tom Cruise? Crystal? You remember that, Sam? Any questions? Am I boring you?
No.
Fascinating?
I'd go with the latter.
Good. Jordan, you have any questions? Samantha? Heather? Nick? Daisy? James or Jim?
James,
any questions? You're happy? Radina, you're happy?
I have a question.
Good.
It's not directly related to this.
Is it related to anything I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay, shoot.
Actually, it was related to the article yesterday.
Shoot.
Okay.
If you can make it related to this.
Oh, okay. Then
can't be off on a tangent here. Okay, well, we'll talk about that at break. Any other questions or any questions? Okay, let me move on then. So what is genetic engineering? And what does it do? And I've taken a long time to build up to this, and you're going to see exactly where I'm going in a few minutes. But the point here is that your chromosomes contain many, many, many thousands of genes. How many genes, Kyle? What do you think? What do you think?
I wouldn't know.
Just guess. One?
No.
Ten?
Are we talking about all the chromosomes?
Yeah.
On the order of...
1,000s? Millions?
Million, maybe.
Jennifer, what do you think? Million.
Billions?
Billion genes. Radina?
Thousands.
Thousands. James? Tens of thousands.
Something like that, like
65. Tens of thousands. Anton?
Millions.
Millions. Daisy?
5,000.
5,000. Ben?
30,000.
100 million.
Mizail, how many?
100 million.
100 million, wow. Josh?
30,000.
Matt?
40,000.
Tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands. How many say tens of thousands? How many say millions? How many say 10? Well, we have about 30,000 genes in your chromosome. No different than tobacco plants, which is another topic for a few minutes. But the point here is so you have thousands of genes. And what genetic engineering allows one to do is to purify any one of those genes and separate them. Can you turn that off or mute it? From any of the others. That's really important. So that's what genetic engineering does. It allows you to purify, to isolate a very specific gene from a chromosome. It's the only way you can do it. Before genetic engineering, you studied chromosomes and genes as a whole, as a collection, as a population. With genetic engineering, you can purify individual genes, take them out of their chromosome, and put them in other places and build them up. The second reason why we use genetic engineering is to be able to amplify it. It's only a tiny, infinitesimal amount of a gene in a cell. It's a very, very, very small amount, less than 10 to the minus 12 grams. And you don't have enough to study. So you want to be able to amplify it. In this case, as you know, and we'll go over it more in detail later, you can do that in a bacteria or something else you want to amplify. And then you want to use the gene that you've isolated apart from all the other genes to study something. You can study the nature of the gene. You can study how it works. You can study what its function is. You can use it for DNA testing. You can use it to make drugs. You can use it to engineer animals. You can use it to engineer plants. But the point here is you can use it to correct genetic diseases in man. But in order to do all that stuff first, you've got to be able to isolate that gene, and you have to do that using genetic engineering. And one of the examples that I can give you is that if you looked for the globin gene, which is the gene that makes the red blood cells red, globin, G-L-O-B-I-N, and if you isolated every globin gene in your entire body, you'd only have about 50 micrograms, 50 times 10 to the minus 6 grams. But if you clone that gene and put it in a bacteria, and you allow those bacteria cells to amplify and grow and produce a population, in one test tube, in one big, I should say, flask, you can grow 10 times more of that gene. Individually, purely, away from all the other genes and be able to study it in a very nice way by itself. And that's the power of genetic engineering. Another example is the way cheese was made was to take from the stomach of cows, isolating thousands and thousands, cheese is still made this way for the most part, of this substance called chymosin, which is important in breaking down milk proteins in order to make cheese. It's a very expensive and very time-costly process. But if you cloned that particular gene from the cow that made that protein, you could then have that protein and make cheese without getting millions and millions of stomachs from cows in slaughterhouses, and so that's been done too. And the reason why that's able to be done is because you can purify this chymosin gene from the cow chromosomes, you can identify it, you know what it does, you can put it into bacteria, and you can get that bacteria to make tons and tons and tons of this protein, and that protein then can be purified, and you can use this to make cheese. We got the protein from an animal making cheese. I wonder what that says about kosher laws. We'll talk a little bit about that because it does provide a little bit of some philosophical and ethical conflicts and did, but it all seems to work out because a gene's not considered to be an animal and therefore it's okay and doesn't break down these particular laws. And believe me, people thought about these religious considerations in doing these kinds of experiments. So in simple terms, genetic engineering means isolating the DNA from an organism, breaking the DNA into a bunch of pieces in specific ways, identifying a gene from all these other genes, tens of thousands of genes, let's say in human beings, purifying them using recombinant DNA, amplifying them in bacteria and in other creatures, and being able to look at specific genes and manipulate them. But in many more respects, genetic engineering means that we can manipulate these genes in any way we want. And I said that on Tuesday. What I mean is that we can break them apart, put them back together in different combinations. We can take a piece of one gene and mix it and combine it with a piece of a gene from some other gene. In other words, what I'm saying is we can take pieces of different genes, we can recombine them, we can add other things to them, we can get anything that we want to be done using the rules of genetics and using cellular processes. There are no limitations. And as I told you on Tuesday, recombinant DNA, as you will see in this course, really, even though we're studying it from a historical point of view, isn't really used anymore because we have the ability to synthesize a lot of this stuff. And therefore, that's the first step. But in many respects, we don't do that as much as you would think that you would do from listening to me. We're way beyond that, as you'll see. This is ancient technology. Ancient, ancient stuff. When was the last time you cloned a gene, Javier, from scratch?
I think I never did.
This is a PhD postdoc in my lab, molecular biologist working with genes, and listen to what he said. He's got a PhD working with genes. He spent his whole thesis working with genes. When was the last time you cloned a gene?
I cloned a gene? I never did.
You never did, but you've worked with genes for how many years?
For like 7 years now?
7 years, and he's never cloned a gene, but he's worked with genes. So that's how far we've come, where people can work with genes, but they never know about cloning genes. So we've gone way beyond that. The important point that I want to say is that this technology has brought about some of the most profound and exciting changes in society that you can imagine. One of the first and most profound changes that this technology brought about was a whole industry started, an industry that didn't exist when I was a young assistant professor at UCLA. There was no biotechnology industry when I was in graduate school. None. Zero. It did not exist. This technology sparked a multi-billion dollar industry. And that means that this industry also started a whole branch of law, a branch of law that deals with the patenting of genes in living organisms. And so there was no patenting of living, well, I shouldn't say that. There was patenting of plants before this, but no patenting of genetically engineered organisms using the new recombinant DNA prior to this technology being invented. And so that led to a lot of different issues with patenting genes, patenting genetically engineered organisms. That giant mouse can be patented. Someone can hold a patent on that genetically engineered mouse. And a variety of other examples that I could give you. and we will talk about for many weeks in this class. So the point is it raised issues of patenting genes, it raised issue of patenting living organisms, it raised issues of genetically engineering human beings, it raised issues of genetically engineering other organisms, it raised issues of releasing genetically engineered organisms into the environment, it raised issues of being able to use this technology in forensics, DNA testing. That meant it raised issues of privacy, confidentiality. That means it raised ethical issues of do we test, do we not test? What if we have the gene? What if you have a gene that you can't do anything about? Let's say the gene causes a disease you have no cure for. It raised all of these issues. It changed the way in which we think about ourselves because it allowed genomes to be sequenced, and we found out that we're not any different than a chimp and we're not that much different than a mouse. Melissa, what do you think the difference is between mouse chromosomes and human chromosomes? We 20%, 15%, 30%, 40%, 1%, 5% different. A mouse and a human.
Guess 15 to 20%.
15 to 20%. How many would say 5%? How many would say 15%? Mouse and a human. How many would say 20%? How many would say 1%? Well, it's about 5%. And every gene on your chromosomes in the exact order can be found in the exact order of a mouse. We've learned the fact that we're not that different from a mouse or a goat or a dog or a sheep or whatever, except the way we can think and process information. And all of that has been learned because of genetic engineering. So we have to think about, from a philosophical point of view, and I mean this, where we've come from and what we do, particularly if you can synthesize genomes, which we can, and get them to work from hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. That raises some very profound questions in terms of the origins of life and where we've come from and all of those other kinds of issues. But out of all this technology, what we've learned more than anything else is the knowledge of biology. Because we've learned more about biology and how we function in the last 30 years than anything else. And as Mike showed you in discussion yesterday, and as Gloria told you, every biology book that you can get your hands on, 90% of it is new since the advent of recombinant DNA, because that's how we've learned about how cells function, it's how we've learned about the proteins in cells, that's how we've learned about what a gene is. We never saw a gene before recombinant DNA with our eyes. That's what allowed us to look at a gene, and there were some startling, startling surprises. And so this is big stuff. And when you read that article for discussion yesterday, what you read was, in my opinion, perhaps one of the most important biological experiments of all time. Because that experiment allowed us, you, me, and everyone else, to direct biological evolution. Because that's what genetic engineering can allow. When we take a human gene and put it in a bacteria, we've changed the bacteria. We're getting it to be able to make a human protein. That bacteria was never able to do that before. And that's a very profound thing. When we take this individual girl who would die with ADA, a lethal disease, and we give her the gift of life, and we allow her parents to experience her full life for as long as they live and she lives together, that's the power of this technology. And that's very profound, because we've never been able to do that before. And tragically, in the old days, that individual would die. And that raises all kinds of other issues in terms of fit genes and unfit genes and eugenics and all kinds of things that I'm going to get to in a few minutes today. Radina, take the microphone and help me out here.
I don't know if we're going to cover this later, but are the patent laws that govern genes used to treat human diseases different than the ones?
No.
They're not?
No.
So you could theoretically own the patent to a person?
No. You cannot patent things in their natural state. So you cannot patent your genes in their natural state in chromosomes. The patent laws are very specific in this regard. We're going to spend a lot of time on this. The patent law said that something must be touched, quote, by the hands of man. That's the overarching rule. It must be touched by the hands of man, meaning that the gene in your chromosomes is in its natural state, and the natural state of matter is not patentable subject material. However, if I isolate your gene by recombinant DNA, I needed to have a very specific process to do that. And when I isolate your gene by recombinant DNA technology and put it in a bacteria, it's no longer in its natural state. Therefore, I've intervened by some act the hands of man. And now that's patentable, what is called patentable subject material.
But then what about, is that what the insulin that...
Insulin can be, that's exactly right. So when you take a human insulin gene and you put it in a bacteria, the bacteria produces insulin, you're allowed to, one, have a patent on that bacteria because now it's a novel thing, and you're allowed to have a patent on the process of recombinant DNA. And I will give you the Cohen-Boyer patent when we talk about patents, because the thing that you read about yesterday is the subject of the first genetic engineering patent, and it's a marvelous patent. And there's a lot of really fascinating things associated with this. Patents is not ownership, it's intellectual property. Betty, take the microphone. Does that answer your question? Go ahead.
I wanted to ask, like, so we have 30,000 genes, and there's only 5% difference between, like, a mouse and us, and we know how to put genes in, so is it possible to, like, switch a mouse to a human being?
Ah, what do you think the answer to that question is?
I think it's possible.
You do?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Do you think that perhaps out of those 30,000 genes in human beings and mice, they might have to interact in some way? Do you think that the processes might be a little bit more complicated than that? Do you think that those 30,000 genes are all identical to each other?
I think if we know how to take them out, then we would be able to put the human genes in and make humans out of, like...
Well, how many genes do you think are responsible for human consciousness? Do you think it would be one gene or many genes?
I think many, many genes.
I think maybe thousands of genes. What do you think the genes are that are responsible for human consciousness? Where do you think they function?
In the brain?
Yeah. And how many genes do you think are necessary to make a brain? It's a wonderful book written by E.O. Wilson on this called Consilience, which gets to the molecular biology of consciousness. But the point is that you'd have to understand brain functions in humans, correct? And do you think that the functions of brains are simply due to one or a few genes, or might it be a lot of proteins interacting with each other in the neurons in very specific ways?
A lot.
And maybe only subtle changes in genes can make very profound differences. So if I say that the mouse gene is the same as the human gene, maybe they have some subtle differences, but those subtle differences can allow us, when they're interacting with each other, to have consciousness and be a human being because we're not a mouse. What genes in the mouse might you think might be more profound than the genes in a human being?
Oh, the smelling.
Yeah, exactly, and that's in fact the case. The mice have many more olfactory genes than we do, and they're much more sophisticated, but yet we have the same kinds, but we have many fewer. And this is what we learn from these genome projects and genetic engineering that we never have been able to learn before. Are there any other questions? Uditha. Just remember, I might ask you to answer your own question, so go ahead.
With the insulin and the girl with ADA and the new cells that are added to the body, how do they keep the body from rejecting it?
They're using her own cells.
They pull out her own cells
and engineer and put them back.
What about the insulin that people take, like that they inject into themselves?
It's human insulin, and all human insulin is the same between everybody.
There's no antibodies on it or anything?
No.
Okay, thank you.
You don't reject it at all, okay? Yeah, Charles.
I thought there was a type of diabetes.
Be specific.
About the insulin? Mm-hmm. I thought there was a type of diabetes where your body actually rejects the insulin.
There's a lot of different forms of diabetes.
And
Insulin resistant and all kinds of things, but it's way beyond my knowledge and expertise and certainly beyond the scope of the class.
Sorry.
And it's totally, it's different than this. Okay? Okay, a couple more and then I'm going to move on. Sam?
Is there a difference between fixing genetic diseases, as you call them, like the ADA, and fixing or altering genetic variants? Like, is there a difference between making everybody's hair blonde and fixing that, or fixing albinos?
What do you think? Difference morally, difference ethically, difference
I assume it's not different biologically and scientifically. Mm-hmm. So my question would be, is there a bright line between what a genetic disease is, what isn't a genetic disease, what genetic variation is compared to genetic disease?
I think that's
disease.
Something that all of us have to answer, and we'll talk about that later on in the class. There might be a fine line in which you might say, I think it's good to be able to cure someone of a lethal genetic disease, but I don't think it's good to be able to engineer someone so they don't have to shave their legs every morning or every week, which is a whole company that's been founded on, to be able to use gene therapy so that people don't have to shave, so that they don't have any hair, and so they no longer have to go sheep and have this stuff ripped off them, which I understand is quite painful, which maybe some of you may or may not know about. I'm not one of them. In any case, go ahead, Heather.
My question is, when you are curing a disease like with the ADA, do the cells completely that you fix, I guess, do they completely replace the, I guess, defective cells?
No, the defective cells are still there, but it doesn't matter because you only need so little amount of this enzyme that they can function quite normally.
So
you have a population of normals and you have a population of disease cells, but doesn't matter. Normal cells really produce all the function that you need to be able to have an immune system. Yes.
So would it be possible, say, for if this was a woman or a father, like to grow up and be a mother or a father and pass only the defective cells on to their child?
No, because that the laws of genetics, as you'll see, you can pass the defective gene, but it depends upon how many copies of the gene you have. So if you have two copies of the defective gene, then you're passing it 100% to your embryo, so to speak, your zygote, your fertilized egg. But on the other hand, if you have one normal and one, it depends upon genetics, and we'll talk about that, okay? All right, so let me move on then. I think I've said enough about all of these different kinds of things, and they raise a variety of issues, and all of you will have the results of your opinion poll, which I was going to go over, but for the sake of maybe brevity and time, I'm going to skip, because clearly, in the old days, this was extremely controversial technology. And then the controversy died down. But then it was sparked again. And the controversy with respect to genetic engineering only falls really into probably one category, dealing with food and with plants. But everything else is really almost zero controversy. Everyone probably thinks with the proper controls and with the proper careful procedures that it's probably a good thing to use this technology to treat diseases and help people, keep people alive, and make people healthy. And we'll talk about perhaps the reasons why this has spilled over into the area of agriculture in a very, very, very profound way. Let me ask the question to all of you, the question of whether or not any of this technology is anything new. Genetic engineering, we're talking about being able to clone genes, isolate genes, get these genes, do what we want with them. Is this a new technology? And I would submit to you very strongly, even though the technique... What did I say, Sam? What was the word I just used?
Technique.
Even though the technique... Can you say that again? Even though the technique may seem sophisticated and profound and maybe even a bit foreign to many of you, the technique of genetic engineering, this technique has been used for, in a different way, for 10,000 years. But the same process. We're talking about manipulating genes. We're talking about manipulating genes in very profound ways. Daisy, can you catch this, please? What is that? Take a guess. What's it look like?
A plant.
What part of the plant?
The leaves.
Mm-hmm. The leaves of a plant.
Yep.
You agree with that? Shauna, can you catch this big cauliflower? What am I looking at here?
It's a piece of cauliflower, and that would be like the flower of the, or the seed of a plant.
So it's not the seed.
Like, would it
is
be
it the flower or the seed?
It's the flower.
It's the you're it's positive.
Like, yes, it's like
you'd bet your life on it.
Yes.
Okay, it's the flower. What's this?
Those are just the leaves.
Those
right?
are the leaves. What is that?
This is the flower.
Uh huh. Josh, can you catch that? What is that? Can you hold it up? Where's the third microphone?
It is...
Give it to Daisy.
The stalk and the flower of broccoli.
Oh, we got flowers here. Hold up your flower here. Shauna, I see a flower. Hold up your flower, Josh. Do they look the same? Lotta, they look the same?
It's Lota, and they look similar.
But they're not
but
the
not
same.
But not exactly the same.
What's the difference?
Visual difference?
Yeah, what's
like,
the difference?
That's green and that's
well, what
white.
Else do you see that's different? Hold it up.
That one is surrounded by leaves and the stems are separate.
And what do you think about it? Is this kind of a smooth top? Are there things that are separated from each other?
They're not separated in that form, but when you pull
what about
them apart,
in this form?
Those
are
more
separate from each other? So they look different, don't
yes.
they? Not that yes. profoundly different, but they look different. You'd agree?
Yes.
One is white, one is green, correct? What about that leaf there that Daisy has?
That looks more different from the other
looks
two.
Looks more different than the others. A lot different, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. What about these things that I have in my hand here? What do you think about this? Another mat here. What are those things? Hold it up. You ever see any of those things?
Yeah.
Hold it up. You like that stuff?
No.
I don't either. It's gross. What are they?
What are these?
Well, what part of the plant is that? Daisy, you want to hold up with you? What part of the plant is that?
I don't think I've had these since I was seven.
What are they?
What
is it? Udita, help.
I think it's a brussels.
Yeah, but what part of the plant are we looking at here? What are they? Some ear.
Leaves.
What are we looking at? You're positive?
I want to bet my life on it.
But they look like leaves.
Yeah.
They look like these leaves that Daisy has?
No.
But they're leaves, right? But they look different, don't they? So we have a Brussels sprout. What is this, Daisy?
Leaves.
From what plant? Matthias?
I really don't know.
What is it? Who knows what this is? Samantha?
Kale.
Who?
Kale.
Yeah, kale. So we have Brussels sprouts, we have kale. What's this thing? Cauliflower. We have Brussels sprouts, kale, cauliflower. What's that over there? Broccoli. What's the difference between the genomes? What's the difference between the genomes, Chris, of those plants? Yeah, grab a microphone. What's the difference between the genomes and the chromosomes of those plants?
I would guess it's pretty small.
What do you think?
As a percentage?
Well, in general.
What's that mean?
1%, 10%, 0.1%, 0.001%?
0.001%.
Or less. Are they the same species or different species? What do you think? They look really different. I mean,
I
you
think
know
the
that
same.
Cauliflower. Hmm?
I think they're the same.
You know?
No. I certainly don't. That's why.
Who thinks they're the same and who thinks they're different species? How many would say they're the same? Sky? Are they the same or different? What do you think? Guessing or do you know? Don't know. How many would say for certainty that they're the same? Samir or Samar?
Samar.
Samar. How, what would you say?
I would say
they're closely related species. One person says they're the same species. One says that they're cousins. What do you think? How many say different? Raise your hands high. Smile, Hannah. How many say different? How many say the same? Okay. Chris, I want you to come down here. Let's get Jennifer down here. Let's get Samir down here. And let's get Rebecca down here. Let's assume that for the sake of argument, these different vegetables, here's the kale. Thank you, Daisy. Matt, here's the Brussels sprouts. Thank you. Here's the kale, the Brussels sprouts. Where's the cauliflower? Just throw it. Thank you. There you go. Who would say, if those are the same, I want you to propose a hypothesis to say how they got to be different. I want you guys group together and think about what could be a reason.
They're the same species, but they just have
different. Okay, what's the hypothesis? Let's assume they're exactly the same plant. When I say the same plant, they crossbreed with each other.
We are prepared to hypothesize.
Go ahead. What's the hypothesis?
They appear different, though they are the same species, due to environmental differences.
Okay. But what would be the prediction then if that was true?
That if...
What would be that prediction?
The same...
They could interbreed.
They could crossbreed. If there was environmental differences, what is the prediction?
They would grow in different environments.
But what is the prediction if they grow in different environments and they're different? What could you do?
If two plants grew in the same environment, they would look the same?
Yeah, and what if you did that experiment? What do you think would happen? Imagine the whole broccoli industry and cauliflower industry dependent upon the light and the sun in a certain day and a certain geography. Would you think that you'd start a business about that?
Well, I think they could be simulated, the conditions.
Yeah, you think you could have a whole multi-billion-dollar industry based on the weather?
No, on simulating the weather.
Yeah, okay. What do you think would be another hypothesis? What's another hypothesis?
Can we confer again?
Yeah.
They are the same species. Just mutations mixed with
other pollen when I was growing. Okay, what's the hypothesis? Go ahead, Sommer.
That they're the same species?
Yeah, and how come they look differently?
That's a good question.
Who made these plants?
Humans.
Humans. When were they made?
I don't know.
You don't know. What do you think? Jennifer, what do you think?
Long time ago.
What's a long time ago? I mean, long time ago for you is like 20 years. But what do you mean by a long time ago?
Like hundreds? Like
hundreds of years. Take another guess.
Thousands?
Thousands. That's exactly correct. Thousands of years. So who made these plants thousands of years ago? Chris? What do you think? Think that they just sort of made by themselves? And do these things exist in the wild?
No.
They don't exist in the wild, I can assure you. Particularly cauliflower. They ain't going to exist in the wild.
So how did they make them, or why did they?
How did they make them? What?
Farmers crossbreeded different plants.
Well, we're saying it's the same plant. How did they find these things? What did they find?
Mutations. Or
what did you say?
Mutations.
A mutation. So what would be the mutation that makes the cauliflower, Jennifer?
The color.
One is the color. Okay, that's one mutation. So we're going from green to white, right?
Size
of
the
flower. What would be another mutation?
Size of the flower?
The size and shape of the flower. So now we're exaggerating how many flowers there are on the bud in which the flowers come out. I mean, you know when you get roses, there's one flower at the top of the stem. This has many, many, many flowers at the top of the stem. So it's a mutation that affects the color and the shape and number of the flower. What about the broccoli? What's being affected there?
The stalk size.
The stalk size is being affected. So now we have a slightly different shape of the head of the flower than the cauliflower, and the color is different, correct? Where's the Brussels sprouts?
Here.
What's being affected here? The color?
The leaves.
Well, what about the leaves?
The size too.
Yeah, the size. What about the kale? Is that the size of the Brussels sprout leaves?
No.
Well, what is happening here? What's your hypothesis, Sommer?
That thousands of years ago, like hunter-gatherers started breeding.
Well, we don't know who did it. We don't know what they were or how. Just give me a hypothesis. You know, it could be Bill Gates. I don't know, in a previous existence.
Someone started breeding out these traits.
But how did they find these traits? How did they appear? Did they make them? Did they genetically? Well,
they were just mutations that
they just found them spontaneously.
Like the start of them, and then kept.
And then they kept them going. What does that say about the trait for these wrinkled leaves? What does that say? Is it inherited?
Yes.
What does it say about the trait for these little leaves? Is it inherited?
Yes.
What does it say about the shape of this? Is it inherited?
Yes.
What does it say about the lack of green color and the white versus the green? Is it inherited?
Yes.
Do you think that if I gave you the green gene and I put it in this white plant, it would work?
Yes.
And if I made this cauliflower like a broccoli by genetic engineering, I could do the same thing, couldn't I?
Yeah, broccaflowers.
It's a little bit different, a little bit different, but I could do the same thing, right? So what do you think was happening at the molecular level thousands of years ago when these people were playing with these different kinds of genes? What do you think, Matt? So how did the first mutation occur that went from green to white? Give me a hypothesis.
There's a genetic...
Is there a gene that makes green color, maybe?
Yeah.
And what might have happened to that gene for green color?
It might have gotten lost in the shuffle for the cauliflower.
Lost or, let's be more specific.
Didn't get expressed.
And what is that called then?
Mutation.
Yeah, so the gene for green color got mutated. It's still there, but it's in a different form, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It hasn't gone away. It just doesn't work normally, correct? But now it's still there.
Yeah.
But it's working in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
But we have green and we have white, correct? So now we have two different forms of the same gene. They just do different things, which we'll come to in a second. What about the gene for the leaf shape? What's your hypothesis on that?
That the, for the...
Was it the same gene? Is it the green and white gene, or is it a different gene?
It has the green gene, but it has a different gene for the
different
leaves.
Genes are different forms of the same gene. It's the same plant. They can interbreed with each other. They have all exactly the same genes. How come the Brussels sprout is small and the kale has big leaves?
Because they were...
What caused the small leaves compared to the big leaves? What's your hypothesis?
The order in which they were? Like the...
No. You're making it too complicated. Much too complicated. What did you say about the green leaves and the white leaves?
They were expressed in one, not the other.
What about small leaves and big leaves? Could it expressed be a, another gene? Could it be another gene? A gene for leaf size?
Yeah.
And maybe that gene could be producing small leaves in one and big leaves in another, because they're different. Because maybe this gene mutated to be able to only form those small leaves. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah, it does.
What do you think about that hypothesis?
I think it's the right one.
And I don't know if it's the right one or not, but do you think that these things had to be inherited in order for people to find a mutation, have it stable, and take it up and work with it and study it? Absolutely. Thanks, guys. So the point here is that this is a process, kale, cauliflower, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, all of those are exactly the same plant, Brassica oleracea. They have exactly the same genome. They have exactly the same genes. All you're seeing is differences in the form of a particular gene. In the case of white, it's the form of the gene that no longer can make green. In the case of the big leaves, it's a form of the gene that makes big leaves. In the case of small leaves, it's the form of the gene that makes small leaves. They're all the same genes. What I'm saying here is that this process of genetic engineering has gone on for thousands and thousands of years. Do you think, Brian, coming back to you, that if I took the gene for greenness and injected it in the egg of the white plant, and made a green plant, that it would function any differently than what people were manipulating years and years and years ago?
No.
No, it functions exactly the same way. You're seeing something outwardly, but you're seeing the manifestation of a gene that's functioning inside of a cell. And that gene is replicating, it's directing the production of a protein, it's making whatever it needs to make. And by genetic engineering, we can isolate this, and we actually know the basis of these particular genes. So what I'm saying here is that genetic engineering is a very old technology. And it's old because every single solitary one of the plants that you get in a grocery store, whether you go to Hughes or Vons or Gelson's or Ralph's or Whole Foods or whatever you go to, there's not one vegetable that you buy. I'm going to say that over again. There's not one vegetable that you buy. Not one, from broccoli to cauliflower to cabbage, that grows naturally in a wild population. All of the plants that you eat were engineered thousands and thousands of years ago, including corn, which cannot exist in the wild on its own, never could because it is the ultimate genetically engineered crop and vegetable. And it was all done by harvesting mutations that appeared spontaneously and then kept inbred by what I call primitive genetic engineers. But in a sense, all they're doing was harvesting mutations that take place in different genes and keeping those mutations, which we call genetic variability. What about this big tomato? What about that small tomato? Would you say those tomatoes are different plants?
No.
So, Kyle, they're not, right? But one's really big and one's really small, right?
Yeah, they just bear different
fruit. So what's your hypothesis for the difference? Based on what we've been...
Over years, you've got different plants that grow different...
No, I want a very specific hypothesis. How come we have a big tomato and a small tomato?
One plant was selected for variations that led to, say,
what kind of variation?
Say one grows smaller tomatoes and one grows bigger
Why?
Tomatoes.
What's your hypothesis? What have we been talking about here for the last couple of days?
Random mutations lead
in
to different
what?
Traits.
What are they called?
In the genes.
And what would be the gene that would be mutated that you're looking at there?
There is obviously a mutation.
Hold it up.
Obviously a mutation that led to bigger tomatoes.
Or a mutation that led to?
Smaller tomatoes.
What would be the simplest hypothesis?
Probably smaller
tomatoes.
It's
always Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is always the best explanation. Probably big to small as opposed to small to big.
Yeah.
Although it could go in either direction. You agree?
Yes.
Hold those tomatoes up. How do you know the existence of a tomato-sized gene?
Because there's a difference.
And, well, that could be due to an environmental effect that the small one didn't get the proper water in insects. But how would you know that there's a tomato-sized gene? What have we been talking about early on with the DNA? Brian, how do we know?
Because it can be passed down.
Because it can be passed on from generation to generation. So mutation is a stable change in the DNA from generation. You know the existence of genes by looking at that. Charles, how do you know the existence of hair color genes in human populations?
Because it can be passed down.
Charles, look around the room. Tell me how many different colors of hair you see.
Natural or life?
Ouch. Let's assume everything's natural.
Like four or five?
Any shades in between?
Yeah, there's a lot.
Like what? Start calling them out.
There's blonde, and then there's brown, and then there's black, and then there's kind of in between blonde and brown.
Mm-hmm.
And there's white.
Yeah. If we could find that gene and change it, we'd be millionaires, billionaires. I could make a fortune on that. Exactly. You think those genes for hair color are inherited? You think in looking around the room, there must be some genetic basis of hair color?
Yes.
By the virtue of seeing the differences among us in this population and knowing that it's inherited, you infer that there's genes that control hair color?
Yes.
So what is the key to identifying genes and then being able, in the case of agriculture, using them? What is the key? What if we all had the same hair color? Would we know that there was a gene for hair color?
No.
So what's the key here in identifying genes? What is it? I'm hearing it. Variation. So mutations of changing one gene to another gene allows us to identify a particular gene. And that's what was been done and has been done for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And so we have genes, and we have genetic variability, and we have genetic variability which has manifested itself by mutations. And I want to harp on this again. We have genes, we have genetic variability, and this genetic variability leads to alternate forms of the same gene. And this genetic variability is due to mutations. And this genetic variability allows for everything. This genetic variability allows us to have different traits, different smiles, different hair color, different facial features. It allows for being able to select different crops. We have the same genes, we have mutations in these genes, but we're selecting for these random mutations. But they're all present in these populations. So look at all these different tomatoes. Look at all this genetic diversity. Look at all this randomness in terms of genetic change. That is the raw material upon which crops were bred and engineered using genetic engineering. You can't do genetic engineering unless you have some genetic variability, as you will see, either classically or by using molecular approaches. And that's how the principles of genetics were found, because what Mendel did with his pea plants was to use round and wrinkled, same gene, yellow and green, same gene, different forms of the same gene, purple and white, same gene, different forms of the same gene, tall and short, different forms of the same gene, etc. But furthermore, what Mendel showed was that those traits can be passed on from generation to generation to generation, so that there were principles of genetics. That is genetic variability at work. And what I mean by the same gene here, Chris, and I know that this is kind of abstract, is there it is as a chromosome, and there are these genes that fall along the length of the chromosome, and genes have discrete positions because they're a discrete piece of DNA. And if you look on this chromosome, you can find out the position of that gene on the chromosome. And notice that you can find a gene for a particular shape of a tomato, but it has an alternative form by mutation, has a different shape. Or you can find an orange tomato and a red tomato. Or you can find a small tomato and a large tomato. Or a teardrop tomato and something which is round. All of that's due to genes being mutated in alternate forms and is due to genetic variability. And as we're going to talk, probably the last lecture in this class, is what is the basis of this genetic variability in humans and how does this relate to who we are as races and all these other kinds of things. But clearly, every domesticated animal has been selected because of this genetic variability. All of these dogs have been bred because of genetic variability and mutations in different genes. And we know that because the dog genome has been sequenced, and we know what this variability techniques. And I want you to really understand that. When you do classical breeding, you're not doing anything more than manipulating genetic variability classically, which is a technique, but the result is the same. When you use genetic engineering, you're manipulating genes and genetic variability, only you're using molecular techniques, but the result is the same. We just are able to do a lot more because we can bridge the species barrier and we can bridge a lot of other kinds of things. But the fact of the matter is, giving you a profound example, is that our ancestors 10,000 years ago bred for the size of seeds, meaning if they could make a bigger seed by breeding, they get more food. There they are. So all of these crops have much bigger seeds than any of their wild ancestors. Well, we now know what those genes are. And using the processes that I've been talking about in class, we can, in fact, engineer a small seed into a bigger seed with one gene. So we can do the same thing. In other words, what I'm saying is that 10,000 years ago, our ancestors didn't know what these genes were. They just bred for them empirically. But now we know what they are. Nick.
Are the sizes of, like, I guess, in this case, seeds, I mean, you can have a smaller or bigger relative to a certain size, but is it, how far does it go? I'm sure it's not infinite, but I mean, how big can you make a seed? Could you make a seed this room size, or, I mean...
What about a coconut?
Coconut?
Coconut has a seed in it. One seed, it's pretty big. It's like a baseball. Bigger. Could be like a grapefruit. Mm-hmm. That's a huge seed. Now, the coconut plant is different than a pea plant, but it ain't that different on an evolutionary scale. Mm. So the answer to your question is yes, you can go from a tiny little seed to a huge seed. That's a very profound question of how that happens. But to answer your question or to rephrase your question, what's the difference between a mouse and an elephant? It's the same kind of question, isn't it?
How come the mouse
is small and the elephant is big, but there's really not that different. The mice and the elephant aren't that different on an evolutionary scale. So it gets to the question of what is controlling size and shape and form of organisms that are closely related. And that's a very profound question. We're getting lots of answers to that being able to isolate the genes that are involved in those processes. And I just showed you one that might be involved in seed size. The question is how far you can go using genetic engineering is still an open question. What about the size and shape of the flower? Well, if you were living 10,000 years ago, you'd want to get more seeds on a flower, so you'd want to engineer for bigger flowers, and that's what was done by using classical selection and classical molecular biology. Now we know what those genes are, at least in part. And so notice, taking one gene, we can go from a small flower to a big flower. So now we understand what some of the raw material was that our ancestors used 10,000 years ago, but the processes are the same. The processes of replicating the gene, the processes of replicating and having the gene become functional. Does it always work? Let's say this classical breeding. The goal of agriculture, the goal of breeding, is always to make a better organism using the principles that you can. And at the beginning of this century, when genes were just discovered and people were trying to breed different kinds of plants, and particularly in the Soviet Union or the burgeoning Soviet Union, where there's lots of famine, there's a lot of pressure to get the yield of crops up as high as they can have. And so right after the Russian Revolution, there was a geneticist by the name of Karpachenko, and Karpachenko was given a grant by the new Lenin government, and Karpachenko's charge was to produce a plant from two closely related species, a cabbage and a radish. Now, mind you, this is after World War I, and there was millions of people dying, literally, due to famine, and what Karpachenko was supposed to do was to make a plant that had the head of the cabbage and the root of the radish. So now you could grow in one plant twice the amount of food. And the cabbage and the radish are not that far apart. They're different genera. It's not the same species, but they're not that far apart. So Karpachenko set out to do this and to learn how to crossbreed these, which he did. And so what Karpachenko did in 1929 or so was to take a cabbage and to cross it with a radish. And what he got was the first really genetically engineered plant done man-made. It's a classical experiment in botany and plant biology, but it had the roots of the cabbage and the head of the radish. It was useless. And he was shot, literally, as many famous Russian geneticists were in this period and afterwards. And so because he was deemed to be a big failure, he was shot and was killed, but yet it's a very important experiment. But yet it shows one very important principle. Sometimes by using classical genetic engineering, by using breeding methods, you don't always get predicted results. On the other hand, as I'll show you and have shown you, using genetic engineering, most of the time, 99.99% of the time, you do get predicted results. And we're going to come back on that theme in a few minutes. Okay. Do any of you have any questions of what I've said so far? Is it clear? Do you understand intuitively that when one breeds for crops by using domesticated animals, using classical genetic engineering, you're just manipulating genes, but doing it classically by breeding? You're manipulating the existing genetic variability that exists in that population. You're taking advantage of random mutations. But yet you're still manipulating them by breeding and changing. Everyone would agree in this room that the kale is a very different looking plant than the broccoli. But yet they're the exact same genus and species and they crossbreed. We've just taken advantage of this variation that occurred naturally in these genes, meaning they work slightly differently. Same gene, just works slightly differently. But we would agree that we're engineering these plants because we're getting a directed result. The primitive genetic engineers, our ancestors who did this, were looking for a specific result, this broccoli. They saw it and they kept it and shepherded it and harvested it and used it. Genetic engineering that we're doing today is absolutely no different. We have a gene for insulin. We know that it produces a protein that can help cure, or not cure, but treat disease. We put it in a bacteria. We're taking advantage of the fact that we can get this gene to be active in a bacteria, and make a protein and use it to be able to use a drug and have people treat diabetes. What we're doing is we're doing exactly the same thing, only using more sophisticated techniques, albeit people could argue, yes, we're breaking down the species barrier, yes, maybe we're tampering with evolution or God's hand, so to speak, but the fact of the matter is that from a molecular point of view, from a biological point of view, from a DNA point of view, Brian, are we doing anything different? The processes of manipulating how these processes work is the same. We're just using different tools. The classical tool is a much blunter tool than the sophisticated tool we have now. I can assure you that Wright's airplane is a lot less sophisticated than the space shuttle or things that are used to get things to land on Mars, but the process is very much similar. Uditha.
Using the classical technique, though, you can't break the species barrier, right?
Yes, you can, actually. Oh. There's a handout that you have which shows the evolution of wheat.
Okay.
And wheat bread that you eat has actually broken the species barrier because wheat is a product of a cross between a variety of closely related species of wheat plants. And so, yes, you can break down the species barrier in some respects. But if you could break it down completely, you wouldn't have a species because the definition of a species is two organisms that are reproductively isolated from each other. And so there's shades of gray here. Okay? Any other questions? Yeah. Ben. Sam, rather. Go ahead.
Is the process of the classic genetic engineering,
hard work. Go ahead.
Is this any different than stuff that occurs in the natural world, like birds only eat the biggest, birds eat the biggest seeds in one area?
It's a little bit different. We're talking about genetic processes here. So in a sense, what you're saying is, let me rephrase it, is the process that we're talking about in terms of genetically engineering natural variability by the hands of man any different than maybe what Darwin saw on the Galapagos and what you saw yesterday in the film that may have been done by advantages in different environments or not? And the answer is, in principle, it's the same process. There is existing genetic variability in populations. Look around this room. When we DNA fingerprint all of you, you're going to see a lot of genetic variability among all of you at the DNA level. Would you agree, Sam, there's genetic variability in this room?
Yes.
And might you agree that in different environments, potentially, some of us might be able to thrive relative to others?
Yes.
Okay. So in that case, instead of the hands of man acting on that genetic variability, we have more environmental factors doing it because man, quote, wasn't involved in that particular process. But the key is that genes are still being manipulated, different forms of the same gene, which function in slightly different ways. In one hand, we have primitive genetic engineers saying, God, look at this broccoli. I want to keep that. I don't know why I have it. In the other case, it just happens in a normal environment because some organism can behave at 20,000 feet better than at 5,000 feet or vice versa. Okay. A 103 years ago, to be precise, only 100 years ago, how many of you have grandparents that are close to 100 years old? You know, like in their 90s? Can you raise your hand? Does anyone have grandparents that are over 100, close to it? How old? Great-grandparents, of course. Okay. Your great-grandparents were born before the rediscovery of genetics, and they're still alive today. And think about the fact that only in the century in their life we've gone from not knowing about the existence of genes to sequencing the human genome. That's very profound. And so over 100 years ago, approximately 105, laws of genetics were rediscovered. And those laws of genetics were rediscovered, and the principles of genetics that were espoused earlier by Mendel, but of course he burned all his papers and no one knew really what he did except for a few selected people, those laws of genetics were rediscovered, and genetics as we know it as a science was born. What do you think is going to be possible 1,000 years from now, Lotta? 100 years we go from not knowing what the gene is to knowing about Is there a question? We can go from not knowing what the gene is to being able to know what every single solitary gene in your chromosomes are. What do you think we're going to know in 1,000 years?
The genes of almost all organisms.
Yeah, we'll know the genes of almost every organism on the face of this earth. What do you think we'll know about biological processes? Are they infinite?
Yes, I think.
Biological processes are infinite? Is it an open system?
Or
is it closed?
Closed.
What do you think?
Let me think.
Could you possibly know everything there is to know about a cell?
No.
You don't
I don't think so. Because a cell can change.
Well, but that's the change in genes, and we know about that process.
Okay.
But is it possible to know everything
then,
there is?
Yes, in a specific cell.
And is
I
it
think
possible
so.
To know about all the properties of maybe all cells 1,000 years from now?
Yes.
Is it possible to know about how every one of your human genes works?
Yes.
You think it'd be surprising if you were able to go ahead in time 1,000 years from now, they wouldn't know about how all of your genes work?
Based on how quickly we've come, yes.
Yeah, we'll probably know about how all of your genes work within 20 years, let alone 1,000. Would you think it would be surprising 1,000 years from now that people would look around a room and see genetic variability and say, we know the basis of this genetic variability. We know why certain groups do this, certain groups do that, certain people think this, certain people do that. Do you think we'd know that? Just
yes.
Might we even know about what consciousness is all about at a biological level?
At a biological level,
yeah,
yes, I think so.
Not in a spiritual level, so to speak, but I would debate that they're really not disconnected. But the fact of the matter is we'd probably know an awful lot. And would you say 1,000 years from now, and I'm giving you a leading question here, would you say that perhaps people might think it very strange to have kids the normal way? To take a chance on having a kid that might have some serious disease of some kind?
Yes, I think so, because like with the phenylnutrionics.
Or whatever.
Yes, I think that people would try to.
So if you knew that you could guarantee genetically, not that your child, if you're going to have children, would be tall or short or beautiful, or which is a relative term, or whatever, but you knew that the child would be relatively healthy. I mean, they might succumb to heart disease or something way in life or get cancer or whatever, but they'd be reasonably healthy, and you would know that by testing these children. Would you maybe want to do that?
Yes, I think a parent would want to ensure that.
What do you think we'll use sex for 1,000 years from now?
What was the question?
What do you think sex will be used for about 1,000 years from now?
Pleasure.
Yeah, be recreation maybe. Maybe we won't even have sex. Maybe we have little implants in our... Who knows what would happen? What do you think we knew about biology 1,000 years ago? What do you think we knew about biology at the time of Christ?
Not very much.
Do you think we knew anything?
No.
Think we even knew about the existence of cells?
No.
No, nothing. So can you imagine what we can do with this technology, extrapolating 1,000 years in the future, and hopefully things going on a positive plane, irrespective of any minor glitches, which I hope never happen. So we have this technology. So now, let me ask another question, because this gets to the heart of it. Let's go back 100 years. Let's go back 100 years. And let's say 100 years ago, Nicholas, you heard of the new genetics. And I'll give you some examples next week in which how this genetics applies to human beings. Would you be optimistic that using this new genetics, now you're back in 1905, maybe you could use this to eliminate some of the misery that you see around you? Because you see a lot of, from your perspective of 100 years ago, not our perspective, you see a lot of misery, and maybe you even think some of it has a genetic basis. It might be erroneous. You think at that particular period, Gloria, is there, might think about a particular time, might you think about it at a particular period of time that You might want to do something positive using genetics. What do you think, Nicholas? Well, I want to know what you think.
No, I think there's, you know.
What would you think? You're living 100 years ago.
I just said, I think. There's probably a lot of potential, you know.
What would you think? You'd say, it's probably a lot of potential. What would you want to do?
I'm not clairvoyant, but, you know, I think.
What would you want to do? Not you or they or it. What about Nicholas? I. What would you might want to do?
I'd want to find, you know, cures to diseases that probably affect people around me.
Yeah, so you try and find out some of the genetic basis of these diseases. And if they're terrible diseases, might you want to get rid of them?
Yeah, sure.
What do you think that's called? What's
way
that
of the
called?
Future?
Hmm? What do you think that's called?
Genetic engineering?
I know the air conditioning went off in here. There's nothing I can do about it.
Genetic engineering?
There's a specific word for it. We heard about it. Were you in discussion yesterday? We had a film about it. What's that called? Were you in discussion yesterday? What is it called? We had a movie. Charles?
Is it eugenics?
Yeah, eugenics. Eugenics. So we have these new laws of genetics. We know that there's human genes that are affected and cause diseases like phenylketonuria and a whole bunch of others. We don't know about, you know, feeble-mindedness and all that stuff, but you can imagine how they must have thought in their own simplistic way in those particular days. But we have this altruistic idea of being able to perhaps eliminate people from this misery by altering their genetic makeup by intervening with those genes. And how would they have intervened with those genes in those particular days? How would they have done that? Matt?
Those particular days?
Yeah, 100 years ago. How would you intervene in those in that genetic process?
I guess deciding who you're going to marry, who you're going to reproduce
with.
Yeah,
we do that all the time. In fact, every single solitary one of you practices eugenics. Every single solitary day, you bump into somebody and say, hey, I'd like to hook up with them because I like what they sound, they smell like, they look like, or what they feel. And if that ain't eugenics, I don't know what it is. Is there anybody in this room right now that would walk randomly down a street and have sex with someone who is a complete stranger? No, how many people here would do that? No, raise your hand. Come on, I want to see. Is there anyone in this room that would like to choose who they decide to have children with on the basis of maybe what they look like, maybe what they talk like, maybe what their intelligence is, maybe a does everyone choose particular traits that they like? What do you think?
Yeah.
That's eugenics. I mean, it really is, if you think about it. We don't randomly mate in human populations. So the point is, 100 years ago, people thought that maybe it'd be kind of a good idea to be able to intervene in human populations genetically. But what they thought was that there was good genes and bad genes, and they applied cultural definitions of these genes. And what they wound up doing was passing laws in which they forcibly sterilized women to prevent them from having children. And those laws were really, as we will talk in this class, on the books for many, many years. Only just went off the books a few years ago, actually. And there's a very classical case that I'll talk about and pick up on next week. A very classic case in... How many of you had constitutional law, by the way? Do you know the case of Buck versus Bell, Nick? The facts of that case was that Carrie Buck was deemed to be feeble-minded and been in a family that had feeble-minded for many generations. She was told by the state's attorney general that she had to be sterilized and could no longer have children. She took that case into the courts in the 1930s. And that case went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. Who was Oliver Wendell Holmes? pretty well-known one. Would you say one of the most distinguished ones in American history? I would say so. One of the most distinguished chief justices of the Supreme Court. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, in the case of Buck versus Bell, U.S. Supreme Court, mid-1930s, said, it's within the general welfare, which is a clause in the Constitution to promote the general welfare, that the police powers of the state can be used to sterilize Carrie Buck because, and I quote, one generation of imbeciles is enough, quoting Oliver Wendell Holmes. And so the eugenics movement, in acting on this so-called genetic variability, as you saw yesterday, started, as you will see, and I was going to show you a tape, I'll show it perhaps next time, started with very altruistic motives, but then got twisted in many different ways. And so 100 years from now, we will be addressing many of the same kinds of questions, hopefully not in that kind of way, but we'll be addressing, and we are now. I told you the example of this individual that has this lethal genetic disease in which you've engineered this person to have a healthy genetic disease. Would you say that's eugenics or not? What do you think, Ben? We're improving her genes. Or it's either improving genes or it's either positive eugenics where you add good genes or negative eugenics where you take away bad genes, whatever that means. But would you say that's kind of a form of eugenics in a sense? We're improving the human gene pool by adding a good gene?
Yes, it is.
Only if it's inherited. And in this case, it wasn't inherited. So in a sense, we're not using eugenics. So you're only changing the genes in a human population if it's inherited. Okay. We got a lot of work to do in this room to get the air conditioning fixed, Jessica, because it's off, and to maybe get this din fixed by next week, okay? Are there any questions, issues, comments, stone throwing, whatever? What I'd like you to do is to, and I'm going to let you go because I let you go really early last week, on Tuesday. What I'd like you to do is really work on that quiz and understand the process. Hold on. Process of genetic engineering. Come to office hours tomorrow. Hold on. Come to office hours if you need it. And what I'd like you to do is to think a little bit about some of these issues because they're going to come up time and time again in this class. And so pick up your handouts, your articles. Pick up the things that are here before you leave. Make sure you have them. And those of you that are going to dinner, Jessica will take you over to the Faculty Center, and I'll meet you there and have a good weekend. Thanks.